So today, we're going to be looking at a focus of Romans 1, 28 through 32. And I'm going to have a little bit of an intro to some of this to help you understand kind of the background of it. So the greater context is Romans 1, 18 through 32. And as we go through it, we find nothing happy. Nothing in it is very happy. It starts out with, "And God's wrath is revealed in the heavens." And we're going to touch on that. So we have seen that this is a predictive, progressing, spiraling, increasingly sinful downward progress of hardness of heart, suppression of truth, and rampantly sinful behavior. It's like at every stage, there's more hardness of heart and more suppression of truth as every stage as we go down deeper in any society. Again, not every society gets to the point of fourth stage, what we're going to talk about today. Some societies have characteristics that get to a certain point where tyranny exists, and we're going to talk about that too, what tyranny is. Some people call it freedom for themselves, but it becomes tyranny for other people. So God's wrath is revealed in the heavens. But I never talked about that at the beginning, what that meant. What does it mean to have God's wrath revealed in the heavens? So God revealed his wrath against sin since the announcement of Genesis 3:15. Genesis 3:15 talked about a virgin-born son who would be born, who would crush the head of the serpent, Satan, and in the process, his heel would be bitten. That is, the death blow would happen to him while he's crushing the serpent's head. So we have this ancient prophecy that was given to Adam and Eve before they had children. So here is the setup. How is Paul the Apostle saying that the wrath of God is revealed in the heavens so that all people are without excuse? Get it? So back in the day when they didn't have telescopes, back in the day, it has to be something that's universal that all peoples, nations, tongues, and tribes, after Genesis 10, after the Tower of Babel, they could all look at and say, "Oh, I see." But then sin corrupts it and they start worshiping it instead of getting the message from it. Okay? In the Old Testament, the Hebrew word is Maseroth or Maseroth, which is what we call our constellation set, the circle of constellations. And Orion is talked about, and it's really not called Orion. It's a Hebrew word. I don't know what it is. There's the bear is mentioned, which is, you know, the Big Dipper, Little Dipper. You've got Pleiades. The Pleiades is beautiful if you ever look through a telescope. I don't know how back then they could see. Maybe they did have something, but, you know, they could see the beauty of the Pleiades in the head of Taurus. And all of those pictures were there. Therefore, it must have been a universal language. Well, let's go to Psalm 19, and we all know this. Psalm 19, 1 through 4, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork." Okay, so it declares. Notice the words I have in all capitals. Those all have to do with communication and information. They are not throwing out bones on the top of a steel drum barrel or reading tea leaves to try to decipher anything. This is communication language that is meant to be understood. Therefore, it can be symbols. It can be letters. I mean, look at the Egyptian hieroglyphics. Symbols. There were no letters. You know, the Greeks had letters. Hebrew had letters. But there is also a universal way of showing things. Have you ever been to or seen pictures going to other countries and they have the stop sign? A lot of times they have a red hand. They have different kinds of things. And they'll have alto or halt or whatever. But the universal, whatever that picture is something that is cued into all humans, wait or stop. So it isn't that the paint and everything there is shouting out to us. It's that we have a universal understanding to interpret that. So evidently, when God named all the stars, he let us know. Because every ancient people, nation, tongue, and tribe has that. He also communicated something through it, because it says so. The glory of God. Who is the glory of God? in the New Testament, we find out the very glory of God is Jesus Christ. The glory of God, the personification, the embodiment of the glory of God is Jesus Christ. So it's got to communicate Jesus. And day-to-day utter speech, and night unto night, reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Universal language. Their line, that is, some sort of sentence or concept, has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the ends of the earth. So this is definitely something that is communicating, something that God has set up since Genesis 3:15 that tells a story. And so we find that, So the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork day unto day, utter speech. So when you look at the most ancient, the ones that they've discovered in archaeology, as far back as they go, the most ancient zodiacs or constellations, path of life, that's really what it means, path of life, zodiac, have very much the same exact figures for the stars. And they have original star names. Even the Hebrews have those in some mosaics they found. So folks already had original star names, they had original figures, and they had a message. And in most cases, they have a little symbol between Virgo and Leo, what we call Virgo and Leo, the virgin who gives birth to a son who is to rule the whole universe, who later on, when you go all the way around, becomes the lion of the tribe of Judah in the book of Revelation, who destroys the power of the serpent. And he's crushing the head and eating the head off of the serpent while he got bit in his paw, in his right rear paw or something like that. So the picture is always this, Genesis 3:15 all the way throughout. But when I speak the gospel to someone, I'm declaring that they're a sinner, aren't I? When I share the gospel with somebody, I'm communicating something to them. So it can be an offering of salvation, but it can also be a judgment against sin. The same message. If they reject it, they are condemned already. But if they receive it, they receive salvation. In the same way, this universal declaration of God's glory, of the birth of a virgin-born son, who would eventually be this lion who destroys the serpent, is the picture of the gospel, but it's also a picture of the wrath of God. It's also a picture, or pictures, a story of God judging sin. So it's universal, it's out there. What happened with us as humans is we saw the message and we started worshiping those human figures, four-footed animals, birds, and crawling creatures, as Romans chapter 1 says. You see, that's what they started doing. They didn't have evolution. They didn't have archaeology. They didn't have anything that would conjure up these figures. They put them together. That's why there's a universal Queen of Heaven goddess. She is the Queen of Heaven. And it was corrupted. All that story was corrupted by sin, by Satan. So that when Jesus really came, the real virgin-born son, that kind of story was already there, but this is the real one, and there's the counterfeit by Satan. That's where it comes from. It's been there all this time. That's why God says the wrath of God is revealed from the heavens. It's been there. So therefore, they are without excuse. They don't have testing for DNA back then. There's no way they could know all that stuff. So what they had was what everybody had. So I would encourage you to look up, there's a couple books I'll show you later that are what I call very sound. They don't get you into astrology or anything. They just show you the ancient star charts and the Hebrew names and ancient Arabic names and Persian names and such of these stars. The reason what they want to do is show and reveal to you that God has been there the whole time. When it says God named the stars and he tells them all by name, you know that? Well, it doesn't mean anything to us unless he tells us about it, right? So what I could see with my naked eyes, when I'm out where there's no light pollution, maybe in a higher level or wherever, where it's very dry, like the Middle East, I can look up and I can see all those figures. Now, of course, I can see them and I can see their distinct cluster of figures, but of course I'm not drawn out like a man and whatever. But for God, God uses that to communicate his glory. And we must know that the glory is Jesus. So why is there a little figure over the top between the Virgin and Leo? Because there was a Sphinx. But in this case, it's a woman's head and the body of a lion. That's the key to unlock a circle. Because a circle is like arbitrarily, I could just start anywhere and start the story. God wanted everybody to know it starts with a virgin who ends with a lion who rips off the head and crushes the head of the serpent. I mean, is that not the story of the Bible? Starting with a virgin, the promise of a virgin coming, ending in the book of Revelation, where it says, and the lion of the tribe of Judah, he has conquered, he has victory, he is the, you know what I'm saying, he's prevailed. I mean, amazing. I mean, how is the book in the stars so amazingly parallel to the book called the Bible? Because it's the same book. He created the stars, he created everything, and he communicated everything. So I just want to share with that with you, just to give you a kind of a primer on that. Some people have gone into it so deeply that it's like, well, if the moon is in this phase and all these different things and I can predict. No, that was never the intent. The intent was always, here's this communication that a virgin-born son is going to happen. He is going to be the Redeemer. He is going to save the world from sin, but he's also going to judge sin. The wrath of God is revealed in the heavens. Simple, it's a message. And we were supposed to take heed to it so that when the virgin-born son comes, like the Magi, oh, we saw his star in the east. All of a sudden, the star that relates to that virgin-born son that's a figure, all of a sudden, it got bright. And they go, ooh, we saw it happen. And they knew that was the time that Daniel had echoed down to the Magi. When you see this. I don't know how he knew that. But they came. We saw his star. So evidently it was common knowledge. They saw his star. Other people groups around knew there was a Messiah coming. Knew there was a Redeemer coming. And they mentioned the star. So that's God's pure way of doing it. God's judgment, and that's just a picture of the zodiac right there, kind of. But God's judgment is revealed in the heavens, and it is holy. It is justified. And God's wrath against sin is justified, and it led to what? Worldwide flood, confusion of languages at Babel, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and her sister cities. I might even add the deportation of Israel. You know, and Judah, Israel, the northern 10 tribes are deported because they came all the way down to fourth stage. They went to the fourth stage and they were so sinful that God had to get them out of that land. And Judah, southern kingdom, did the same, but they were deported and then came back. And then also a key to understand the Bible. This is good for us all to understand from Genesis 10 onward. To the end of the book of Revelation, it's a tale of two cities, Babel and Jerusalem. Those two cities are introduced in Genesis 10 and Genesis 14. And they have a ruler that begins differently. So Nimrod is the ruler of Babel. Melchizedek is the ruler of Jerusalem, the king of righteousness. Melchizedek is a real human being. And he had two offices, priest and king. And the same way, Jesus will be priest and king on the throne of David forever and ever. So we have two different cities, and this is the battle between this system of belief system called Babel, which is exalting self and disregarding God and replacing God with something else and doing it my own way. Or Jerusalem, which is Jesus or God is on the throne, And it's God's redeemed people. God's redeemed people. And even though Jerusalem now is not following God, she will someday. And not only to mention the new Jerusalem. The heavenly Jerusalem is named Jerusalem. So which one wins? Babel is destroyed in chapters 16 through 19 in the book of Revelation. He finally destroys that system. But Jerusalem is redeemed and exalted. And that's his people. So if you understand those two systems, the two cities that are there representing the various kinds of things that God is, there's like a war going on between them, then Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32 makes sense. The Babylonian drift of a society is what Paul is talking about in Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32. The drift of a society back to Babylon, to become Babel. So the first thing to go when that happens is God. That is the first truth, the first concept, the idea that God is creator. God is the one who created me. I'm owned by him. We should obey him and thank him and follow him. That's the first route to go. That's the first thing of suppression of truth. Suppression of truth, you'll always see how this happens in every single society. Once a society says, I'm going to start suppressing the truth, that is, throw God out of our schools, I'm going to throw God out of government, I'm going to throw God out of all kinds of public institutions, I'm going to throw him out and ignore him or not use him in jurisprudence and legal proceedings. Anything that relates to God, I'm going to start throwing out, and I'm going to replace him with something else. It will always be replaced. So the first stage is idolatry. We talked about that last week or the week prior. And so God is replaced with just fill in the blank. And then God is no longer honored as God, and that society or people group is gone. And God is no longer thanked. Now, every once in a while you hear, and I even heard Richard Dawkins, where he said, oh my God, or thank God. Now, he's the one that says the God delusion, you know, God is dead, the God delusion. He's an ardent atheist. But he believes that ancient aliens came to seed the earth with DNA, because he knows that the DNA structure in our body cannot happen by accident. It's a zero chance. It's 10 to the 147th power that even one of the proteins or amino acids that could fit within DNA would order itself, let alone the rest of them, and have a full replication system. Isn't that awesome? So the DNA system is information. Remember, we talked about the Maserath or the constellations. They look like just figures, but now we have an interpretation system to interpret, oh, virgin-born son, you know, a virgin who has seed. We know that virgins don't have seed. Women don't have seed. Men have seed. So where did the seed come from? Virgin-born. You see, the virgin. So we interpret what's there because there's a system of a language of interpretation. Same way DNA. Full system of language. Full system of information. Be able to replicate itself and communicate. And to be able to decode and decipher and encode. That is information. And it's a programming language. It's binary and digital. Now they're finding it's a digital layer in there too. Just like programming code. Just like what we're looking at through PowerPoint. Someone programmed this and designed something like this. There's no way that happened by accident. A tornado didn't go through a junkyard and out came a nice computer plus it's a 747. You know, that just doesn't happen. Even over millions of years, it will only get rustier. It only, you know, disintegrate. It doesn't integrate. It disintegrates. So in the same way, they didn't thank God. They didn't even honor God. They just said, we're going to do our own thing and ignore truth that is already there that shows that God exists. So what did they break? They broke the first through fourth commandments. They worshiped other gods, They made a graven image. That is, imagery is in the head. So they imagined other gods, imagined how origins might have occurred, imagined, you know, it's imagination. And it's unholy imagination. So then we have immorality. We talked about that. So God gives them up to the lusts of their heart, sinful lusts. So because of their giving themselves over to other beliefs and other gods and rejecting God and started worshiping all the creatures, they started worshiping the various things in the stars and the heavens. They did. They worshiped those creation figures. So then God says, I'm going to just give you up because this is really what you want. You really want this. So God gives them up to the lust in their heart. And so what did they do? They dishonored their bodies. And here's the principle. If we don't honor God, if we don't honor God, we will dishonor ourselves. If we don't honor God, so as a society, you'll see that happen. Individuals, you'll see that happen. So they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. That's the conclusion. And that's what happens when a society gets that place. Because what do they have? They have a different thought in their mind. You know, I know my ancient ancestors said it's not good to do these kinds of things with my body. But you know, that they're old. They don't really know what's going on. This is today. So that thought is there because they suppress the truth. It allows those thoughts to come in. If you didn't suppress the truth, if you're saturated with God, saturated with His Word, saturated with loving Him, then those thoughts have no place in your life. So it gives place. Once you move God out, then other things come in. It's the same way as a garden. If you can fill your garden full of all your vegetable products, then it has less room for the weeds to be. I know weeds still get in there, but it's not overflowing with weeds. It's easier to take care of them. So see how that works? So you take care of your garden, take care of your mind, take care of your heart. Make sure God is the one who is saturating you. So they go along with the crowd, and this is what happens. I don't want to be left out. I don't want to be looked at as a prude. I don't want to be looked at as, just a weirdo. I want to be in the in crowd. And that's where it starts. Peer pressure starts. The cultural pressure starts. The various pressures of the world start to. And then what you do is you're guided by fear. Even though you know what you're doing is wrong or those thoughts that I should give into, there's still this other pressure here to not rock the boat. I want to fit in. I don't want to be alone. I don't want to be an outcast. And so they broke the seventh and the tenth commandments in that process. You know where it says, don't covet your neighbor's wife. Coveting, which is the tenth commandment. That's a mind thing. It's not doing anything. And they broke it by doing the seventh, which is don't commit adultery. And that's basically what that is. Committing adultery. Committing fornication and any kind of sexual relations outside of marriage, but mostly heterosexual. Now, this is where the third stage, which we talked about last week, and God says this is abomination, it's wrong, it's unnatural, it's horrible, it's not right. It is against, it's opposite, it's upside down, it's twisted from God's original plan of male and female. God's original plan of male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his mother and father and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Jesus echoed that too in Matthew 19. So we have this universal understanding of what marriage is all throughout the ancient world. They knew what marriage was. Didn't mean they all abided by it. Didn't mean they all did it. But they knew what it was. Why is that so universal? Because it goes back to an original. It just doesn't happen by accident. Someone had to explain this, and God explained it. God did it. So it's unnatural, and I give you these references, and these are in my notes you can download, but you can go reference them. But you'll see that God, from the beginning, doesn't like what the third stage is all about. It's just totally, completely wrong. And they are to be killed in the Old Testament. They are to be stoned and killed. So I know in the New Testament, Paul didn't tell the believers in the body of Christ, hey, if this is happening, you know, go take them out behind the church building and kill them. Never said that. So in the New Testament, we're, you know, amongst the Gentile nations. We're not in Israel anymore. But God still looks at it and says, that leads to death in their life. And they will suffer within themselves the due penalty of their error, it says. They will suffer. And it's it doesn't mean that they're not redeemable. Again, that's what 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 9 through 11 says. It says, and such were some of you. So some of those sins, all of those sins that were listed, some of those people there came out of that lifestyle. They were rescued. So God is able to redeem out of that. And then today, it is the last stage. This is the last stage. This is a stage where it's a point of no return. It is a snowball effect. And you all know what I mean by snowball effect. Have you ever done it? Take a snowball, roll it, and roll it down. Mine only gets like 10 feet and it stops. I've never had mine go all the way down and get so big that it destroys buildings. You know, like in the commercials and such. So, but you understand, it's a, you know, an effect that on its own mass, on its own weight, continues to go, and there's really nothing you could do. It's only a God-sized intervention that can stop that. And so once we enter into this stage, and I'll explain where we're at as the Western world, once we start into this, it only ends in tyranny. It ends in tyranny and then destruction. It is unrestrained, prideful arrogance. And the first stage of it is seeking approval. So you've gone through the first three stages, and they're just doing it. But now they want all of society to approve of it. And they want to have parades about it. They want to have laws about it. So this is signals the end of that society. I mean, that's really what it is. It's full of arrogance, tyranny, pride, boasters, despisers of those who do good. It's horrible. But we need to read it. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, this is Romans 1, 28 through 32, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. And that is when tyranny starts. Tyranny always starts. This is like the climax of tyranny. Tyranny can start at any of those stages, really. So we saw tyranny start with Nimrod, who is the first king, in the first stage. They never really got to these other stages because God came and confused the languages. But there was tyranny already going on. But this is the ultimate climax. This is where tyranny, it's just going to happen no matter what. The other ones optionally can have tyranny. That is suppression of other people's rights. Suppression of anybody speaking out about it. That kind of thing. Okay? So at those first three stages, tyranny can arise in different ways. Like Hitler. Hitler would have been in the first stage. He didn't get to these other stages. Although they were moving that way amongst the troops, and you find out a lot of the crazy immorality that was going on all the way to stage three. Stage four was just about ready to begin, and the Allies came in and destroyed and wiped them out. So they were wiped out before they really got into full-blown. But they started out with tyranny. It was subtle, but eventually the chancellor became the dictator in Hitler's case. So let's also look at a prophetic view. Now, go back to this passage. In Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32, Romans 1, 18 through 32, it is Paul looking back. He says, and they did, and God gave them. He's looking back at past tense. He's looking back at past tense. So he's looking at, you know, ancient Rome, ancient Greece, Sodom and Gomorrah, Israel. He's looking at, you know, Tower of Babel. He's looking at all those different kinds of societies. And he's finding a predictive model of how it was. And these are the stages. But he's looking backwards to have a template from which to look at of the various stages. So from a programmer, from an engineer, from a historian, you can see structure, you can see details, you can see something predictive. Now when we go to 2 Timothy chapter 3, we see something where Paul is talking about our time. He is not talking about the time that he lives in, but he's talking about the end of days. He's talking about just before Jesus comes back. He's talking about the last days. Now, it's true that the last days, in a sense, began when the day of Pentecost happened and the church age began, in a sense. But in this sense, he's talking about the end of the last days, the final stages. And this is what he says, but know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. It's perilous only to believers. It's perilous to only those who love God and love his word. It's not perilous to these people. They like it. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and such, and from such people turn away. So this is not talking about people who had never heard. This is a rejection. This is people who have rejected. This is people who can be religious or maybe not. I mean, think of Islam. Islam is religious, but it's not like what we saw with all that outward immorality. They may have inward and secret, but they're out killing those kind of people that are like that. I mean, they're putting them to death. So outwardly, they're moral, okay? But at least from that standpoint, this is not what it's talking about until you get down to verse 5, having a form of godliness, but denying its power. So Islam is included here, or any kind of religiosity is included here. So he's including something that is not included in passage 18 through 32 of chapter 1 of Romans. In that, it's just full on polytheistic, atheistic, pantheistic something. But it's not like the religiosity of Islam, what we see. Islam would want to kill all those people, literally kill them, or try to get them to not do that by much restraint. Isn't that true? I mean, you see it all over the world. So he's not talking about Islam. Here, this can be included, but it's everybody. This is the whole gamut of what we see now, isn't it? What I highlighted was lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. That means they had something about God introduced to them, and they chose to rather go after games and entertainment, because that's what pleasure is. Games, entertainment, and those kinds of things that fill their life with pleasing themselves instead of God. They wanted to please themselves instead of God. So an interesting little thing there, that this is also predictive, but it is fully predictive in the sense that God is being thrown out. In Romans chapter 1, verse 28, it says, and not wanting to retain the knowledge of God, they throw God out. It's a systematic, progressive, predictive agenda. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that what we've seen in our society? Not wanting to retain the knowledge of God. I don't want to name him. I don't want to talk about him. I don't want to have any reference to the Bible. I don't want to have any reference to anything that relates to any conceptual ideas that relate to the Bible. And so that's what we see. And then we see despisers of good in 2 Timothy 3:3. This is interesting because it's best translated as despisers of those who do good or hold to good. So when I'm commenting on something on the internet and it's about something that's openly immoral, and I say something like this, I feel sad for our society that it's moving towards Sodom and Gomorrah. I'm praying for her. I'm sad. My heart is broken. So once I put that out, and this is real, this really happened, I had these despisers of good fill that for about 6 days worth of comments that were just saying that I am wrong and they are right, withholding to the things that God says are wrong. They hold to that as good. And they want to tell me about this and how bad I am and how horrible and what a hater I am. And so this shows you that those in the last days will be despisers of those who hold to good. And we're seeing that rise right now. We're seeing this oppressiveness. One guy said, you should just shut up and go away. You're going to find out that's the goal. That's the root of tyranny. So it's irrational, bitterness, hatred of those who do good. This is the root of persecution. When does persecution occur? So the fourth stage is when society as a whole is rapidly moving toward massive approval of every kind of sinful behavior, forcing everyone to go along with it. And if you don't, you will suffer the consequences. Knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. This always, always leads to tyranny, despotism, and then the society's total destruction. It always leads to that. It never ends well. So once a society starts entering into the stage of this fourth stage, it is very, very hard to get out of it. I know of no historical instance in all of history where it ever turned out good. It is the hardest stage in all of history for the gospel to penetrate. It is the hardest stage for any kind of goodness of God to intervene into, because the hardness of men's heart, human hearts, are so hard that they will not listen. It only takes a gigantic, miraculous move of God to do this. So let me put this scenario out. This is the stage when rampant persecution occurs. This is the stage when any Christian speaks out about anything good and wholesome. Even if you say that I believe marriage is between a man and a woman, you can be arrested in some countries, depending on the context in which you speak it. Western Europe, Massachusetts, Canada, certain parts of Canada. They're trying to repeal those laws right now in parts of Canada, especially Alberta, you know, and British Columbia and such. So they didn't know the repercussions of ordaining same-sex marriage. They had no idea the repercussions of how it would affect public schools, education, all those things. There's a great video on that on the internet about the repercussions of Massachusetts as a case example of being the first state that allowed this. But remember, they voted for it. They weren't overturned by a federal judge. They wanted it. And so that's a different kind of situation, but once they want it because they want to be tolerant, they turned a blind eye. So when does evil increase? When good people turn a blind eye, when they turn their face, placate, when they allow, when they don't say a word about it, when they never ever seek to expose the evil. Ephesians 5:11, memorize it, Ephesians 5:11. God commands us to expose evil. Just think of John the Baptist. All he had to do is just shut up and not tell Herod that he shouldn't have taken his brother's wife. But he didn't. He was outside the castle gate saying, Herod, you shouldn't do this. You shouldn't do this. And eventually he was arrested. Now, why would John the Baptist do that? Because he hated Herod? I think because he loved Herod. I think because he loved the idea of government being righteous and holy. He was thinking that it was good. Jesus never rebuked him for doing that. Jesus commended him. The minute he heard about all these things, he commended John the Baptist. And so we, as the church, are called to be as John the Baptist was for the first coming of the Messiah. We are called to be like John the Baptist before the second coming, before the second coming of Jesus. We are the herald, the clarion call of calling the people unto repentance. Just like that song, call all the sinners to join in the song. And so that is what God wants us to do. Remember, Paul started this out with, I am not ashamed of the gospel. And then he is telling a scenario of how the ever-increasing pressure of shutting up Christians would be in a society, to the point where just be quiet and don't rock the boat. Just be quiet and don't say a thing. And it's just the opposite. So the fear of persecution causes good people to be silent. And of course, we are to speak the truth in love, not in arrogance. Never are we to speak like that. But if you think of how the destruction of those ancient cultures occurred, it's because no one was there to stand in the gap for them, praying and proclaiming. Praying and proclaiming. When Jesus called the people to himself and his disciples also, this is Mark 8, 34 to 38, he said to them, whoever desires to come after me or follow me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. I can't think of anything anywhere where Jesus told us to be quiet about anything. Listen to what he says here in Matthew 10, verses 27 through 28. And 32 through 33. Whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light. Whatever you hear in the ear, preach it on the housetops, or preach it from the housetops. Does that sound like he wants us to be quiet? Not a bit. And notice how he talks about the preaching of the gospel or the sharing of the gospel with others and ties it to fear. Remember I talked about fear? The fear of you need to be quiet and not rock the boat. Fear of belonging. The fear of pressure of not being a part of the in crowd. Fear of, well, those people won't like me if I do this. He says, and do not fear those who kill the body. Jesus goes all the way to the ultimate fear. Somebody's going to have a gun to my head. And if you don't be quiet about the gospel, I'm going to kill you. I mean, that's what he's talking about here. He says, if that's your fear, the greatest fear in your life is to be killed. Let me tell you about that. And do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him I will also confess before my Father in heaven. But whoever denies means holding back when you should have told. That's tied with that ashamed. Ashamed is the conceptual root of why you deny, is the motivation of why you deny before other people. But whoever denies me before men, him I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven. So persecution is coming. There's really no way to tell you any otherwise than that we are in this fourth stage. We are just in the barely beginning stages because it's not fully agreed upon in the whole United States yet. But the beginning of approval, of wanting approval, is happening everywhere. And they're trying to find allies. So right now, the majority of the people in the United States don't want this yet. But that's a vestige of Christian culture, not a vestige of Christians. Christian culture, the legacy of our founding fathers, still permeates a lot of our society here. Many other societies never had that chance. So we've coasted a long time with all the assaults of evolution, all these assaults that have happened, and now we come to the end of the age. And we're close to the end. So I don't know what to do other than this. Stand in the gap. We must pray for those around us standing in the gap. Otherwise, God will most certainly have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah, and he will have to judge the United States. He'll use economic disaster. He'll use physical, natural disasters. He may use other foreign powers like ISIS, Iran, Russia, China, to take us over and piecemeal us. He may use the UN, because we have so much debt, to piecemeal us out and become a vassal state. Or God may use all of the above so that we no longer exist. The United States will be wiped off the map and will become some other country or a conglomerate of other countries or something. Or we'll just kill ourselves or some kind of thing will happen. So that is the fourth stage, the end stage of any society. All of Western culture is being taken over right now by Islam, just to let you know. That's a hint. And the Antichrist religion is coming soon. And it is an Antichrist religion. It denies Christ. So that's what Satan does. He destroys a culture to replace it with something more permanent that is long-standing against Christ. And that's what we saw in North Africa and the Middle East. All Christian for hundreds of years. And then they got like this. All those societies coasted with the Byzantine Empire, coasted with all their riches, and stopped being missionaries, stopped focusing on Jesus, and had a Christian legacy. And Islam rose and took it over. So the same can happen to us. Look at Ezekiel chapter 22, verses 30 and 31, right there at the bottom. It says, "So I sought for a man among them who would make a wall and stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land, that I should not destroy it, but I found no one. Therefore I poured out my indignation on them. I have consumed them with the fire of my wrath, and I have recompensed their deeds upon their heads," says Yahweh God. That is what the end game is. Always. Predictable. It will always happen unless there are people who stand in the gap. It can happen. It can happen. The Roaring 20s, 1920s, was going that way very quickly. And then there was a kind of a financial disaster. You remember, you ever read about it? What was it called? The Great Depression, yes. So I think God answered prayers of other people. God intervened somehow. And he showed judgment. But it was a hint of a judgment. It wasn't full judgment. But it devastated the United States. And what did people do? They turned back to God. So that can happen again. God can do something. I thought 9/11 would have done it, but it wasn't. It was very temporary. 9/11 did not do the effect. In fact, we started placating other religions like Islam. So the only thing I can say is for us, actionable, is to stand in the gap and pray for our nation and the Western world. Everywhere Christ's name has been there for over 300 years. This is not so where the gospel is going, where it's never been named. They're experiencing extreme blessing from God in the midst of persecution. And the church is exploding and growing. And they're not going through this because they're at the other end. They're at where God is revealing himself to them in cultures that have been destroyed already. And God is bringing the gospel into destroyed cultures. Isn't that great? So there's hope. But I believe we're very close. We're very close to the end. And so it behooves us to obey God in his call for us to stand in the gap for the lost before it's too late. Amen? Okay, so we're going to sing a song. And this one is a good song.